Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what kind of turnout of the Latino vote can be expected in November, a critical component of Hillary Clinton's coalition of voters that is seeing some defection from the millennial voters who supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries, which, given the closeness of the race at this juncture, could make the Latino vote the deciding factor in who becomes the next president of the United States. Antonio Gonzalez, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization, joins us to discuss the turnout factor and the level of motivation among Latinos, given that Donald Trump, in announcing his run for the presidency, went out of his way to insult Latinos, who he called rapists and murderers. In examining the registration numbers, we will assess whether this constituency that has been referred to as a sleeping giant is aroused and angry enough to stop Trump and his wall he expects Mexico to pay for. Then we'll discuss the corporate culture at the banking giant Wells Fargo, in which employees opened millions of fake customer accounts in a hard-driving sales culture that expected retail bank employees to meet their sales targets. Since the LA Times exposed the scandal 3 years ago, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau began an investigation and this month reached a $185 million settlement with the bank. William K. Black, a former bank regulator who led the investigation into the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s and is the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, joins us to question why the person in charge of the entire consumer banking division of Wells Fargo was allowed to retire with about $100 million while being praised by the bank's CEO as a model of what a banker should be. Then finally, we will speak with Stephanie Taylor, the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who, along with Senator Jeff Merkley and other progressive grassroots allies, have been pushing to revive the public option in Obamacare. With Trump and the Republicans vowing to repeal Obamacare, we will look into the revival of the public option endorsed by Hillary Clinton and President Obama and the need for competition in a market dominated by the big insurance companies. And joining me now in the studio is Antonio Gonzalez, president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter registration participation organization in the United States, the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. During Gonzalez's tenure, the SVREP has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registered in 2012. He currently appears as a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio station show here at KPFK in Los Angeles called Strategy Session. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Hi, Ian.
You had a long journey here, right?
Yeah.
So
rough.
So tell me, what do you think is, do you accept my premise that the Latino vote may end up being the key factor here? Because Hillary Clinton, as you know, the polls have tightened considerably.
Yes,
there's a great
deal
of alarm in Democratic circles. There's been a defection of Bernie's millennial voters to Gary Johnson, and I think there's an element of panic out there. And, you know, even Howard Feinman is writing an obituary. So is the Latino vote going to be the critical one? In other words, does Hillary have to get out every last Latino in this country?
She would be wise to double down on her investment in the Latino vote. Up till now, and there's a lot of criticism on this, the campaign has, I would argue, underinvested in the Latino vote. In the primary season, there's this Hillary-oriented donor community in the northeastern states, in the Bay Area, LA, and they pretty much control the money that goes to all of the organizations and all the entities that do the actual work on the ground. They were really afraid of Bernie and they held back a lot of funding. And then they went through a phase of, well, Trump is so bad, he'll do it for us and we don't have to invest. Now they're investing and there's a lot going on, particularly in battleground states. But they could do so much more. It's a big Latino universe out there. If you look at Nevada, Florida, and Colorado, there's a lot going on. And the Latino vote is Probably the national average of the registration of eligibles is 50%. But in Nevada, Colorado, and Florida, it's well over that. It's over 60% of the eligibles are registered. And you could get to 70%, right? Which would take, that's like African-American levels of organization. But registration is a dollars and cents thing. People tend not, particularly people from low and moderate income, socioeconomic levels, lower educational attainment, typically unorganized people, typically don't just register. You got to go get them. So it's really a question of investment. And there they're doing stuff, but they can do more. They could certainly do more in North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, which are not your core battleground states, but for Latinos. But there's important Latino constituencies there that can really be mobilized and it can make a difference in a short race. The Latino vote matters in a really close race.
Well, but aren't the key ones, though, apart from the swing states, Arizona and particularly Florida? And isn't there a different Latino constituency there? Central Florida tends to be Puerto Rican. South Florida is Cuba, Cuban, the old Cuban immigrants vote hard right Republican. The younger ones, I believe, are more moving to the left. So it's a more complicated mosaic.
It's not the Southwest, right? No. It's not the Southwest where you're basically dealing with Mexican Americans, Mexican origin, and Central American origin, and in Florida, you probably have 20 different subgroups, and there is a more robust right in the Latino community in Florida, not only Cubans but Nicaraguans, other Central Americans, some of the Puerto Ricans are on the right. Puerto Ricans from the island are much more complicated than New Yorkans. And in Florida, the Puerto Ricans are from the island. Mm-hmm. So you don't get, you know, like an 80-20 Latino split in Florida. Until recently, it used to be 80-20 for the Republicans.
Right.
But Obama was able to win 60% in both 8 and 12. And Hillary's around like 55-25 right now. So they could do more work in Florida, not only in growing the electorate and in intensifying the rate of turnout, but also in persuasion. But that's the problem, is that the Democrats and Hillary haven't drilled down in mobilizing Latinos like Obama did, on the one hand. And now they're not doing things at all of any relevance to take back the Senate. The Democratic Senate campaign committee has almost no Latino program of any relevance, and the DCCC, where there's a lot of Latino possibilities and a lot of possibilities for Latino voters to help win Democratic seats for non-Latino Democratic candidates. There's a lot of those, and they're spread all over, including in California and places where you don't expect them, Texas and Utah, but we're not seeing investment there. And it's not that there's not the money. It's just, to be honest, the same old good old boy consultant mentality of sort of hyper-presidentialism. So we're in the midst of that, and there's a lot of acrimony and fighting going on. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'll give you the essentials is there will be a record growth in Latino registration. I think we fully expect to get nearly to 16 million in terms of registered voters. We do expect a high turnout, perhaps as high as 85% of the registered. So we'll be up over 13.5 million votes cast. The polls say about a 70-30, 75-25 in a two-way race, but it's not going to be a two-way race. So it's going to be a little bit different from that. But we don't see a lot of Latino defection to Johnson and Stein. That tends to be the white millennials that are defecting.
Right. But so is the Latino vote then an anti-Trump vote, the 70% or the 75% even?
I believe so. Mm-hmm. And people always ask every day, is it decisive?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's decisive if Hillary wins 45% of the white vote.
Right.
But she's not.
Right.
So, I mean, whites at the end of the day are still 70% of the American electorate. So if we have a record Latino turnout and it's 3-1 or 4-1 Hillary, mm-hmm. and she gets 38% of the white vote, we're not decisive. We're decisive if she performs according to the typical Democratic model, which is 90-10 black, 45 Democrat to 55 Republican in the white community, and then the Latinos are that, you know, the, mm-hmm. the straw that breaks the camel back, and you get a Democratic win, and it's reflected in the battleground states. Trump is like a left-handed boxer. If you know boxing, you know, no boxer wants to fight a left-handed boxer. They have different angles that come at you from a different direction. You don't know how to, you know, a guy with a right-handed jab. You're like, what is that?
Uh-huh.
And so he's all screwy, and he's screwed up the Democratic math, particularly in Rust Belt states and in the Intermountain West, where there's a lot of downscale white working-class Democratic voters. And you know, right now, a lot of these guys are defecting to Trump, so that's why you have a tied race. It's not because of black or Latino performance, really not even because of millennials, although millennials are starting to get blamed a little bit. I think that's, right. I'm calling BS on that.
Right.
It's because of the way Trump, he's overperforming in the white vote in a way that Democrats haven't seen in a while.
And again, I have Antonio Gonzalez in the studio. He's the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the United States, the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. He's a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles called Strategy Session, and which precedes me here at 4 p.m. So
I warm the chair for the big guy.
So, Antonio, does this mean, though, just in terms of the key swing states, is the Latino vote largely, is the critical state then Florida? That would seem to be the case. I mean,
if Hillary wins Florida, the race is over before we even get to counting the votes in the West.
Right.
Her problem now is she's not winning Florida.
Uh-huh.
She hasn't been winning Florida for 10 days. The trend is in the other direction. But Latinos are performing well for her in Florida. It's because of she's just losing ground among the white majority in Florida. It's the same problem for her in North Carolina and Ohio. All those eastern time zone Rust Belt states seem to be trending. Even Virginia, where Kaine, her VP, they had him up 10, and now it's they're up 3 in Virginia. Mm. She's just leaking, you know, a quarter of a point a day, half a point a day, and her firewall is to have a great debate performance.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that's the moment of truth is Monday.
But she's got the most amazing surrogates. Her husband, one of the great political operators. Obama, incredibly popular president. Yep. Michelle Obama gave an amazing speech the other day. And Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and obviously the problem is Hillary.
She's got tools. She's got money. She's got tools.
Right. But it sounds like she doesn't have a good campaign. I mean, I'm thinking
about— What's her message?
Well,
what's her vision?
I keep saying that all the time, and I get a lot of angry mail. And frankly, we do nitpick her compared to giving this other clown a free pass.
The clown has a slogan, Make America Great Again. As much as that drives me crazy, it's a hell of a catchy phrase.
And
with a certain market, it really appeals because people have yearnings for an America, a construct where they had hegemony. A generation ago, and they want it back.
But is there a problem, a Mark Penn problem? Remember, she chose a terrible guy last time. I don't know what Podesta's story is. He's supposed to be a consummate insider. I just get the feeling that they're not on top of things. Whereas, you know, Trump could do very well in this debate. You know, he's got Roger Ailes coaching him.
I think Trump is going to do well. I mean, I don't know that. Hillary's so smart, and she's so detail-oriented and so policy-oriented and so experienced, so substance-oriented. The big question is whether voters care about that or whether they want an outsider that they just want to give a chance. Mm-hmm. You know, think about 2008. The experienced guy was McCain. The outsider was Obama. And the voters, at the end of the day, they said, no, we're just going to give this young African-American a chance. You know, the binary construct of American politics, it sort of works like that when the voters want to throw somebody out. Even if it's a thug like Trump, it can work like that. And at the end of the day, I mean, Hillary's had such a bad 10 days. All of the narrative that hurt her was reinforced in the bad 10 days. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen a day where she's gained back momentum in the polls. And listeners should follow what I follow, which is Real Clear Politics. Right. And it just averages all the polls and you get a real good sense of where things are going. Again, the debate could be pivotal. I think, you know, 538 rep over the weekend said it best. We think it is likely, and I'm quoting, that Hillary wins the popular vote, but Trump could win the electoral vote. And we're looking at that scenario. Right. If things don't change, but who the heck knows?
Right, but are we dealing with these weird intangibles in presidential debates? Remember going back to Nixon lost because of his 5 o'clock shadow? Al Gore lost because the other guy looked like a guy you can have a beer with.
Hillary's near name? Collapse. Her near faint the other day.
No, but I'm talking about in the debates themselves. George H.W. Bush lost because he kept looking at his watch and looked like he was bored and impatient.
Right. Right.
And this young upstart from Arkansas won. So these are the intangibles that happen in these debates. It's scary. And
we can't know.
Right.
We know that Hillary's a good debater. Right. We know she's going to be healthy, hopefully,
right.
and she'll be prepared. Right. We know that Trump is. He's got a good presence, but he hasn't been tested like this.
Right.
But the other thing that we now know is that there's going to be all kinds of surprises every time there's a terrorist hit. Mm-hmm. I think it hurts.
Right.
And they haven't abated yet.
And they didn't respond to this last one very cleverly. Just in the last couple of minutes, what do your Latino Republicans say? I mean, James Fellows came up with this really great term, I think very appropriate, calling these Vichy Republicans, these cowards, these moral cowards that aren't stepping up to the plate and repudiating Trump and are going along with him because... Well, they're just shameful. We know why they go along with him. And their best excuse is we don't want Hillary Clinton picking Supreme Court justices. Is there any chance of them having a come to Jesus moment?
Well, the Bush Republican, Hispanic Republicans are not on the Republican. They're not with Trump. The Romney Hispanic Republicans are not with Trump either. So you see erosion there. And they're doing other things, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're going with Johnson. Some of them, some very prominent Texas Hispanic Republican leaders are now in the Gary Johnson campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So there is erosion on the one hand, but it's probably more elite.
Right.
Because you do see Trump uniting Republican voters. He's up now to 86% of Republican voters are supporting him. Hillary's at 90% of Democrats. Mm-hmm. So Trump has made – you could argue that his gains are from uniting Republicans over the last 2 weeks.
Right.
So I think elite Hispanic Republicans, you do see defection away from Trump, a lot of hostility. But again, look at the media. Some of the best Hispanic Republican commentators were denouncing Trump, and they were on CNN, and now they're not anymore.
Right. CNN's in the bag for Trump. It's disgusting. Thank you for joining us, Antonio. Again,
my pleasure.
Antonio Gonzalez is the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. He is a regular on Tavis Smiley's show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles called Strategy Session. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Wells Fargo's corrupt corporate culture that rewards executives who gouge millions out of customers and get rewarded with $100 million golden parachutes.
So I can come around to
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in residence for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, a white-collar criminologist and the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. He is a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And this extraordinary racket that was going on in Wells Fargo's commercial consumer banking, not on Wall Street, but in their consumer banking, that the LA Times broke the story 3 years ago, then the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the new bank regulation unit that was set up in Dodd-Frank at the urging of Senator Elizabeth Warren, did an investigation, and then just this month, they announced a $185 million settlement when there were millions, over 2 million phony accounts literally cooked up by Wells Fargo's employees to reach their sales targets in an aggressive kind of internal culture at the company. Let's start with, one, why did it take so long? And two, it seems like $185 million for what they did is barely a slap on the wrist.
Okay, so as you say, this story was broken publicly by Scott Record in the LA Times in 2013. And to his credit, the LA County District Attorney credits the LA Times article with causing him to start his investigation, which led him to bring a lawsuit against Wells Fargo in 2015. Meanwhile, he says, again in his press release in connection with this settlement, that he was contacted by over 1,000 employees and customers in response to his civil suit. So this is a case made by whistleblowers and by an effective reporter, a reasonably effective prosecutor in L.A. who simply, you know, has no resources or particular expertise on massive fraud like this, most of which occurred well outside his jurisdiction. So it's obviously one that the feds should have been pursuing as a top priority. There is no public indication that there was really any investigation by the CFPB. In other words, all the facts in the press release pretty much came out 3 years earlier in the Scott Record story, simply the number of folks involved has been updated, but the fraud scheme is clear. And so you're right, we're talking about over 2 million felonies, where it was clearly induced from the top in a cynical way that they could deny all responsibility. In other words, what happened is the lower-level employees did not get significant bonuses for doing these things. They were acting because they were extorted that they would be fired unless they met cross-selling goals that were effectively impossible to meet for most people in most circumstances. And so many thousands of them succumbed to this pressure from the top. The cynical part is the top, of course, then sent out missives saying, we demand that you act ethically and do everything properly, even though they knew that, of course, that wouldn't be the result of threatening people with the loss of their job. So the best employees were driven out of Wells Fargo by this extortion. Many of the employees, despite this, blew the whistle. And you heard not a single word of thanks by the CFPB or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the federal regulator for Wells Fargo. Not a single word of thanks to the whistleblowers, not a single request for whistleblowers to come forward, that there is absolutely not a single person held accountable, even for a fine, much less a prosecution, by the federal agencies. And the Justice Department only announced it was going to start an investigation after being clear that there was going to be a congressional investigation. So this is a complete CYA maneuver. And none of these people, again, have called on the whistleblowers to come forward, which they would love to do if they could get protection from the federal government and blow the complete lid of off this and allow us to prosecute. Meanwhile, the person sort of directly in charge of the branch network announced that she is retiring and she's going to take away over $100 million for leading a system that produced over 2 million felonies. That's how pathetic accountability is in the context of elite banks.
And again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in residence for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, a white-collar criminologist and a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. He is a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Well, it's, of course, the CEO of Wells Fargo is going to be testifying on Tuesday before the Senate Banking Committee, where he is going to be raked over the coals by Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Sherrod Brown, not the least of which, for what you just mentioned, is that I think the senators are going to demand a clawback of this compensation for Carrie Tolstead that you just mentioned, the executive charge of the retail banking division of Wells Fargo, who announced her retirement in July and got this $100 billion gift, I believe.
$100 million.
Yeah,
not
did
billion.
Okay, well, so, that was a slip of the tongue. $100 million gift. And by the way, when Stumpf, the CEO, announced her retirement, he said that she was a model bank employee. And I understand that the senators are probably going to ask the CEO, the demand of the CEO of Wells Fargo in their hearing on Tuesday, to claw back something like how much in bonuses have these executives been paid? I thought it was something like $20 billion, but...
it's more than that.
You sure? My God, yeah. $20 billion is a lot.
Yes, but all of it should be clawed back, every single penny, and she should be the subject of an investigation and prosecution. And there is no indication that will happen. Wells Fargo has a provision that allows clawback, and the way it's written is if it were designed for this. And Stumpf has absolutely refused to take any action, instead has blamed it entirely on low-level employees. And the CFO said they were underperforming employees that were fired. In other words, they were more the victims than the perpetrators. These were the folks who refused, despite being extorted with their jobs, to cross-sell anywhere near as much as the typical Wells Fargo person did. And so the bank, again, in this complete cynicism, fires them, acts like that's fixing the problem when it's actually getting rid of the people who were relatively better, not relatively worse.
But at heart here, this is what the fraud is, though, and this is what's extraordinary about it, is that these employees were directed by Carrie Tolstead and this corporate culture to meet their sales targets by opening phony accounts, bank accounts, and credit card accounts that customers had not asked for. I mean,
well, they would contest. She would say, I never directed them to do that. And this is, again, the cynicism. And this is what people need to understand. Street criminals, they meet their lawyer for the first time in their jail cell. White collar, elite white collar criminals get to talk with counsel and design their fraud schemes with counsel in ways that make it very much more difficult to prosecute them. And so Wells Fargo simply had quotas that were largely impossible to meet for normal people. And then it threatened you constantly with being fired. And people have to remember the last thing for which we have data is that roughly 30% of all tellers, their parts of their family are on federal assistance because they are so low paid. So these are people that cannot afford to lose the job, or their kids literally may go without meals. That extortion is going to be enormously effective. But then as the lawyer, I write letters that you, the CEO and the CFO and the branch manager, send out. And the letters say, you must treat customers wonderfully. You must be completely ethical. You must never violate the law. You must never do these phony accounts. Oh, but of course, the next thing is, and by the way, at your branch, you will be required four times every day to justify why you have failed to meet the quota. You will be forced to work under the threat that you will lose your job without pay to meet these quotas. And at the end of the day, if you can't do it, we will fire you by the thousands. So this is a cynical fraud at the most senior levels with the aid of legal counsel, and it's more reprehensible, not less reprehensible, that there are all these self-serving documents that came out from the C-suite of Wells Fargo. And by the way, this goes back not 4 years. There's an article in Minnesota, what you were talking about, one of my homes, in which the point is made that Norwest acquired Wells Fargo, and Norwest is based up in Minnesota, and thought the Wells Fargo name was more valuable. So it used the name, but the same old manager, Stumpf, and the manager that you've been talking about that got the over $100 million, these are all folks that go back, way, way back, for decades at the Minnesota institution. And they were very big on cross-selling 20 years ago.
Well, but the 5,000 employees were fired, and they were coerced by these very managers, all of whom were rewarded. And, of course, Carrie Tolstead, who I mentioned, got the $100 million golden parachute and was praised by Stumpf as a model of what a banker should be. This is
yes,
the part.
Yes, and Stumpf simultaneously blamed the entire problem on employees, and the CFO explicitly said the employees that went bad were the ones who were underperformers. Now, these accounts weren't simply unauthorized. These were accounts that should not be opened. They were bad things for the consumer. The consumer, if they had been asked and made an intelligent decision, would have said no, hell no, to these products. So, again, it was often the best people in the branches who were fired. And now they're cynically taking credit at the CEO level and saying, look, we cleaned house. We fired 5,300 of our people. Well, yeah, and none of the people who are actually responsible for creating the system that created 2 million frauds.
And these frauds cost the customers, right? These are bank accounts and credit card accounts that the customers didn't need or ask for, but they were charged fees for, right?
That's correct. And also, they were set up in ways where the customer would, in a number of cases, default and harm their credit rating because they didn't even know the account existed.
And, of course, they would pay penalties as well, you know. So
that's correct. And they would give credit cards also. But again, forget the ones, or don't focus solely on the ones that were created without customer authorization. For that's the 2 million cases. But the 10 million case is the consumers who were successfully convinced because of these pressures to buy products knowingly that were bad for them, that they shouldn't have ever done. And so there is quotation after quotation from employees saying, I knew I shouldn't give another credit card to someone who already had three credit cards and was in deep, deep trouble. But I, you know, under these pressures, if I didn't do it, I'd be fired. So the damage goes way beyond the $2 million. As I say, it's going to be in the well over 10 million consumers who got accounts that they shouldn't have because they were, you know, basically tricked into it by people who were under these sales pressures.
Well, what do you expect then, William K. Black, in the Senate Banking Committee hearing tomorrow? You've got Sherrod Brown and Elizabeth Warren, I think, itching to go after Stumpf, the CEO. I'm not sure where the Republicans stand on this, but at least they've allowed the hearing to take place. Will he just be a sacrificial lamb, do you think? Or is he going to, you know, basically be hard-nosed and, you know, blame it on, the, as you say, blame it on these poor, unfortunate employees that were the honest ones, all of whom were fired?
Well, you know, to date, Stumpf has been living down to his name, which in German can mean obtuse and dull. So he's been clunky so far. Mm-hmm. You can bet that the lawyers have been working with him nonstop to try to get him better for this kind of presentation. We will certainly hear some kind of statement crafted by the lawyers that is one of these non-apology apologies.
But what about the clawback authority to recover roughly $20 million in these bonuses paid to the executives who oversaw and overlooked the bank's rampant fraud? And I thought it was $20 billion, but it's $20 million. You say it's probably $20 billion. There's a big difference there. But we do know that Carrie Tolstead, who was the executive in charge of this operation that defrauded these customers, she got $100 million in her retirement package. So there's an awful lot of money out there that could be clawed back. What are the chances of that?
So people need to understand that Wells Fargo is an enormous bank, and that big banks typically pay their senior officers about the bonus tends to be in the magnitude of 3 to 5 times the salary. So the great bulk of the income they receive is from the bonuses. But clawback shouldn't be limited to bonuses, right? If you earn, quote-unquote, earn, you're obviously not earning a salary if you're running a massive fraud scheme. You should lose all of your income. And collectively, the income of the senior officers who are responsible for this is going to be measured in the billions of dollars.
Well, William K. Black, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in residence for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, a white-collar criminologist and the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. He is a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the need to revive the public option in Obamacare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephanie Taylor, who is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. She has spent the last 15 years working on Labor electoral and advocacy campaigns throughout the country. And along with Senator Jeff Murphy and other grassroots allies, she's been pushing to revive the public option in Obamacare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Taylor.
Thank you so much.
And I recently spoke with Wendell Potter, who was the head of PR for Humana and head of corporate communications for Aetna, two insurance giants. He knows the insurance industry inside out, particularly the kind of culture inside of these vast healthcare monopolies. And he recently mentioned, he said, you know, without the public option, there's no way to keep these insurance companies honest. And that's why some of the big ones are dropping out of the health exchanges, just because they're basically able, they've got the muscle to do so. So have we reached a point where the public option is not only necessary, it's absolutely vital for the survival of the Affordable Care Act?
That's exactly right. This is an argument for many of us who fought for the public option during the initial push for the Affordable Care Act, which was that the public health insurance option is so vital because it provides real competition to the private health insurance industry, which is sending our costs sky high and is continuing to send our costs sky high. And the public option would provide that competition and provide a real structural change to the way health insurance is delivered in this country. What we have right now is fundamentally broken. It's a broken system when you're so dependent on private industry. And so we really see the public option as just being absolutely vital to providing that competition. And as you said, to saving Obamacare.
Well, it seems though that Obama had to bring the insurance companies into the tent, and Hillary Clinton had that experience early where unless you invite them in, they'll destroy you. But he sort of had to give away the store in a way to get them on board, promising all of these subsidized new customers. But it seems like they're just completely cynical, and they went along with it, and they've decided that it's not good enough and that they can make more profits by raising the premiums. There's no way to stop them. And the whole purpose of the Affordable Care Act, as stated often by President Obama, was a fiscally responsible one. In other words, we spend more on healthcare than any of the developed nations on the world. We're up around 18-19% of GDP. The Swiss are around 7%, and the French and the Germans are around 8%. So that was always the rationale to take the sort of ideology out of it, if you will, left versus right, liberal versus conservative, Democrat versus Republican. And somehow it seems like we've lost sight of that fundamental reason why we need healthcare reform, which is it's bankrupting the country.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you just made that point about the GDP. It's true. We spend more of our GDP on healthcare than any other comparable industrialized nation. And we're also not getting better care. Among comparable nations, the U.S. has the lowest life expectancy and the highest infant mortality rate. And so clearly there is a very fundamental problem here. And the answer has turned out not to be, let's just require everyone to buy expensive private insurance. Clearly, we need a systemic change, and that's the public insurance option.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephanie Taylor, who's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. She has spent the last 15 years working on labor, electoral, and advocacy campaigns throughout the country, and along with Senator Jeff Merkley and other grassroots allies, has been pushing to revive the public option in Obamacare. So let's talk about the work that you're doing along with these progressive senators. Last Thursday, they introduced a bill. Tell us who's aboard and what the bill does.
Sure. Well, it's a resolution. It was led by Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon, Senator Chuck Schumer from New York, and Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, as most folks know. You know, it's a great leadership crew. It now also includes Harry Reid, Patrick Leahy, folks who have, you know, been in the Senate for a very long time and exhibiting leadership among the caucus for a very long time. The resolution now has 33 co-sponsors in the Senate. And the resolution says we are calling for a public health insurance option to provide competition to the private insurers and to fix some of these fundamental problems in the way we're delivering health care. We also have a website, wewantapublicoption.com, and in the last 5 days, we've collected over 120,000 signatures of people who are signing on in support of this resolution. The coalition is very broad. It includes lots of grassroots groups, such as my group, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. It also includes the Working Families Party, Move On, Democracy for America, and the AFL-CIO. And so it's a big grassroots effort, and it's really an effort that includes, I think, significantly, you know, both Schumer and Sanders, showing that together they're determined to move forward in the Senate with some of these priorities that Sanders campaigned on, as well as the grassroots who are working hand in hand with the senators to make this a priority and move this forward.
And along with Senators Bernie Sanders and Chuck Schumer, you have Dick Durbin, Patty Murray. You also have Debbie Stabenow, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, the two California senators, Sheldon Whitehouse and Al Franken. But on the Republican side, of course, Donald Trump has vowed to repeal Obamacare, along with the Republicans who have made an obsession out of it. I don't know how many times the House has passed resolutions to kill Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. So clearly there's a lot of obstruction on the other side, and one can't expect much from the House. Of course, if the Senate changes hands, that would be helpful. So are we, though, to assume that given this obsession on the part of the Republicans to kill Obamacare, that the insurance companies are more or less in the same kind of bag, in a cynical way, that they're trying to kill it off by abandoning the exchanges and pulling out? Is that where we're headed? In other words, unless the public option is introduced to revive Obamacare, is it inevitable that this political weight against it will prevail?
Well, I think there's definitely political weight against it, but here's the positive thing. I think that we live in a new political environment where the Republicans are actually right about one thing, which is that Obamacare needs to be fixed. I think that we all agree on that. And what we're seeing now with these insurers, you know, Aetna just announced that it's pulling out of 11 states, out of the exchanges. United Health, Humana, they've pulled out. As the private insurers pull out, it becomes more compelling to argue that we need another option because we can't depend on the private insurers. And it's becoming more obvious to more people that Obamacare is going to need to be fixed. And then the question is, how is that going to happen? So what we're doing right now is really working to lay the groundwork to make sure that there's a legislative mandate to act on this in 2017. We're giving Democrats a way to play offense on health care in 2016 instead of playing defense. Like I said, we're in a different world. You know, Clinton has endorsed the public option. Obama endorsed the public option in July. Now these Democratic senators are really lighting a fire, showing the way, paving the way for Democratic candidates to also go forward. And when they're asked about the problems with Obamacare, they can say, I support the solution, which is passing a public option. So we're both creating a path for Democrats to defend and then fix Obamacare, and then creating the way for us to have that groundwork and that foundation laid in 2017 to act on it.
So in other words, Democrats running for re-election in the House and Senate can say, it's true, there are problems with Obamacare. Most of them are caused by the greed of the insurance companies, who are in fact raising your rates, even though they're getting massive subsidies. If we had the public option in there, then we'd have a mechanism to keep them honest, that the only flaw in Obamacare was the expectation that somehow the big insurance companies would play ball and do the right thing.
That's right. I mean, the real flaw in it, that's exactly right. The flaw in it was trying to attack the problem of the uninsured by saying, we will just require everybody to buy insurance, to buy private insurance. And that's not the problem. People are not uninsured because, you know, they just haven't gotten around to buying insurance. They're uninsured because insurance in this country, private insurance, is through the roof. It's unmanageable. And so what we need to do if we're going to, you know, to really assist people in getting onto insurance is to make sure that we're offering a plan that that is affordable, that is competitive, and that doesn't leave people high and dry when private insurers pull out of these exchanges.
So in terms of just the work that you do, Stephanie Taylor, as a co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, just along with reviving the public option, and I think a lot of our listeners were the very listeners who thought we should have had it in the first place. And I think that's a sort of no-brainer for a lot of the progressives, because we all know how other countries operate. And in a sense, it doesn't make any sense really to have insurance companies in the healthcare business, because they are an unnecessary layer. You know, they're like the mafia. Mm-hmm. They don't bring anything to the table. They're just like a protection racket that extracts whatever their profits are, come at the expense of the healthcare. It's an unnecessary layer between the patient and the provider. But given that we have this powerful lobby in the country, I guess we understand why Obama sort of went along with it, but he certainly didn't get a lot of help from a lot of the Democratic senators, one of whom used to work in the insurance industry. And I think he more than anybody killed off the public option. But just in the last few minutes, I'd like to ask you about, since the work you do is designed to get progressives elected, and during the 2012 cycle, Progressive Change Campaign Committee ran a draft to Elizabeth Warren for the Senate campaign. You have raised over $8 million for progressive candidates since your founding in 2009. Just looking at the headlines now, it looks as though, I mean, if Donald Trump has to be the worst nightmare for any progressive, let alone any right-minded American who is going to basically wake up one day if this man's elected and realize, just as the British did with the Brexit, that a catastrophe has happened. How do you prevent that catastrophe? Because I and most of our listeners are getting pretty alarmed.
That is such a great question. I mean, first of all, we should feel good about the fact that the progressive wing, the Elizabeth Warren wing, is ascendant in the Democratic Party. You know, we have a relatively progressive Democratic platform. We have, Hillary Clinton, our nominee, is going forward advocating for debt-free college and expanding Social Security and the public option. That's a positive thing. These are things we should feel good about in terms of the sort of ongoing, you know, corporate versus progressive arms of the Democratic Party. The progressives are definitely ascendant. With that said, we have said from the start that what is so scary about Donald Trump is the populist angle to his message. The fact that he's come out talking against TPP, that he's come out so strongly against TPP, that he talks about jobs, that he talks about wages. Maybe we don't believe it, maybe we don't agree with him, but he's talking about it and in a way that is resonating. And from the start, our message to the Clinton campaign, to Democrats up and down the ballot, is the best way to win is by embracing these economic populist messages. The mood of the country is a populist one. And what we need to do is make sure that candidates at every campaign stop throughout their speech need to be speaking authentically and sincerely about why we need to stop TPP, why people need not just a higher minimum wage, why they need a $15 minimum wage, why we need to be addressing some of these systemic problems in our healthcare industry, in our banking industry, in order to level the playing field. People do feel like it's a rigged system, because it is, and we need our candidates to speak authentically to that. And we saw a real danger from the start in Trump being able to run to the left of Democrats on some of these economic populist issues, and it's vital that Hillary Clinton keep embracing economic populism in her speeches, in her campaigns, and does it in an authentic way in order to bring this election to a successful conclusion.
But given the narrowing in the polls, it does seem that Hillary Clinton's coalition cannot afford any defections. A lot of the young Bernie Sanders voters, the millennials, apparently are drifting towards the Libertarian candidate. And, of course, that surely requires some education there, because when you talk about populism, the libertarians are totally corporatist. I mean, their whole agenda is to, in fact, there's no difference between Gary Johnson's agenda and the Koch brothers. They want to get rid of government altogether and get rid of all regulations, including those regulations that protect the planet, let alone deal with climate change. So how do you deal with that education factor, which seems to be necessary at this point, because I don't think Clinton's coalition can afford to lose anybody at this point.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it has to come from the top. It has to come from Hillary Clinton, and it has to be a sustained effort by Hillary Clinton and also by Democrats up and down the ticket to be campaigning authentically on these populist messages, connecting with millennials on both on their frustrations and their fears about, you know, graduating into and starting their work lives in a rigged economy where they are, you know, saddled with crushing student debt. These are scary times for a millennial, and they need to feel that their economic concerns, like every person's economic concerns, are really being heard and addressed in a real way. And so I think that, in terms of education, really there's nothing better than active campaigning and active, in every ad, every speech, every message, conveying that message and doing so in a way that says, I really hear you and I really understand you, and here's my concrete plan for addressing it in a systemic way, not in a small way, in a real way.
Well, boy, listening to you, Stephanie, I think, my God, why didn't they do this from day one? I mean, it's so obvious.
I know, I agree.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Taylor, who's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who has spent the last 15 years working on labor, electoral, and advocacy campaigns throughout the country. And she, along with Senator Jeff Merkley and other grassroots allies, have been pushing to revive the public option in Obamacare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.